The Tom Woods Show, episode 2196.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody, we all know it is time for us to break up, but everybody's status quo bias is standing in the way of this obvious and humane solution. Check out my brand new ebook called National Divorce, The Peaceful Solution to Irreconcilable Differences, which you can get for free at nationaldivorce.com. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here. I am very glad to be joined by Larry Lepard, who is a longtime sound money advocate. He was very active in the Ron Paul presidential campaigns. He ran two national newspaper ads to support Ron Paul. We'll probably say a little something about that. He's been a professional investor for his entire career. He runs a fund that focuses on sound money and protecting people's savings from inflation. And I just want to talk to him about that. What does the investing environment look like in 2022 compared to in the past, and what should we be doing and what should we not be doing? He is with Equity Management Associates, which he founded, 2006-ish? Maybe I'll ask him that. Larry, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me back on your show. It's always great to talk with you.
I'm so glad you're able to be on a second time, since the first time you were on, you were interviewed by Stephen Kinsella rather than me because I was in the hospital. So these are much, much more auspitious circumstances.
Absolutely. No, I was... really scared me when you were sick, and I'm super happy to hear that you're on the mend, or you're totally...
You know, I have never been in more robust health. I just turned 50. The listeners are so tired of hearing me talk about turning 50. I've been so philosophical about it, but I feel great, you know, and yet even though I kind of feel like the decade of my 50s is the decade where everything's going to start falling apart.
And everything's
been great. I feel good.
Yeah, no, you're good. You're totally good. And if you put in an exercise regime, you're going to be good for another 40 years.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
In the 50s, there's a book out, by the way, you may be aware of. It's called Younger Next Year. It's by...
Oh, no.
Yeah, just in to your listeners, I would advise it. Younger Next Year by Crowley. I read it in my 50s. It's a great book. It's about a guy who was in New York. He was a lawyer, high-powered. He went to his doctor, and his doctor said, dude, you're going to die. You know, if you don't clean up your act, you're going to die. And it tells what he did. And he's, you know, alive and thriving now. He's in his 80s probably. But it was really a very informative book for people in their 40s and 50s and thinking about the, you know, health implications of aging and the things you need to do. And the bottom line is you're going to have to start exercising regularly.
All right. Well, I've been doing that, thank goodness.
Yeah,
I'll check that out. Okay. Let's talk about you and the way you're looking at things and what's going on in the world right now. A lot of people say to me, I don't want to get into the stock market because it's just a casino, it's a crapshoot. In this day and age, it's very, very risky to be in the stock market. And then I have other people saying, well, let's take a minute and demystify, quote unquote, the stock market. You can either open your own business, or if you don't have that kind of risk tolerance or the knowledge necessary to open your own business, you can simply take the money you would have spent on your own business and just invest it in somebody else's. So there's no boogeyman involved here. You've just chosen that instead of using this money to build up your own business, you figure, well, these people already have an existing business. I'll just put my money with them. Right. And so there's really, you know, businesses are still going to prosper, just as they have done in previous years. It's not going to be that all of a sudden, because the U.S. government is doing a lousy job, all the businesses fail. Some businesses still are going to prosper, and you just invest in those. It's just a question of figuring out which ones those are. How should we look at the stock market? And is there a reason that today we need to look at it differently from how we might have looked at it 50 years ago?
Yeah, so that's a great question, and there are a lot of layers to this. I'll try and kind of tease it out. I mean, I think some people are rightly skeptical of the stock market because the way the Federal Reserve operates and the way we've got this free money system, they've been burnt by it, right? I mean, we've had a couple of very big bubbles. I mean, we had the 2000 tech bubble and the stock market went down 50% after that. And then we had the 2008 housing bubble and the stock market went down 50% after that. And so, you know, and now we're now at the peak of, or we just, in my opinion, crossed the peak of another bubble that peaked in late last year. And I actually think the stock market's going to go down 50% again. So there's an argument to be made that for the average uninformed person, the stock market is kind of a dangerous and risky place. But your point is good. If you pick within it, you know, the stock market broadly is, you know, thousands of businesses and industries and everything else. And so the trick if you are going to be in it, or the trick in investing in general, is to get behind a major theme and to be on the right side of a major theme. And so, you know, in today's world, my opinion is that the biggest major theme going on is that we're in kind of a fourth turning where the existing monetary system is slowly but surely, very consistently failing, and that inflation is the new major theme. You know, and stocks, by the way, are inherently risky. They have management teams, and management teams can make mistakes, period. Having said that, some are better than others. And, you know, people who are wise about these kinds of things can help you. So you could buy a fund manager that's good at selecting stocks within the stock market. But I think that the way I would approach it, what I would advise your listeners to approach, the way I would advise your listeners to approach this, Thomas, is you want to be on the right side of a major trend. And you want to ride it for a bunch of years, because the stock market is always going to zigzag. But if you've got a tailwind, what you invest in will do well over years, and it will compound. And people have made great sums of money doing that. You know, if you bought the FANGs coming out of 2009, you made a lot of money. If you bought, you know, the tech stocks in the early 1995 period when the internet was getting going, you made a lot of money. And, you know, right now, I believe the easiest and most, you know, obvious trend that we're seeing is that the monetary system has hit the wall in terms of our ability to add debt. And as a result of that, we're going to see an inflationary, you know, 10 to 20 years and a period where commodities and commodity-related businesses benefit very greatly at the expense of technology and growth-oriented businesses. In other words, said another way, value stocks have never been so undervalued and growth stocks have never been so overvalued. And so if I look at the stock market today and somebody says, and I run into people all the time, say, I have an enormous stock portfolio. What do you think? And I'm like, well, okay, within it, what have you got within that? And I say, there are parts of it that are probably pretty good, but there are other parts of it that I would say are pretty risky, because I sincerely believe that we just crossed the peak of a large bubble driven by free money. And the Fed is now trying to get responsible. And in the process, they popped the bubble. And bubbles typically go back to their base, and we're down 10, 15% off the high. At one point, we were down 20. I think we're going to go down easily 50 to 60%. So if people have money in stocks today, the general stock market, I don't think that's a particularly wise thing to do or a good place to be. Having said that, there are places within the stock market that I think are extremely attractive and undervalued, and I'm sure we're going to cover that. So
yeah, well, that kind of reminds me of when I first met you. When we first met, because, you know, as so many connections happen because of the Ron Paul presidential campaigns.
Right.
And I got to know you because of the full page ads that you ran. And I know we spoke at least one event together.
Yeah.
You know, and we were part of the same kind of movement. And you had a reputation as somebody who had a really good track record with money. Now, there are some people who say that it's basically impossible to, quote unquote, beat the market, because if you have a particular insight, well, then it's already spread through the market by the time you can go ahead and act on it. That the market is very quick to adapt to new information, and there's no reason to think you exclusively have it. So,
you're talking about the efficient market hypothesis.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they basically spun it into a whole theory of why it's a metaphysical impossibility.
Right. And therefore, that anyone who's done extremely well, it's just like, they're like the dumb monkey that's been able to flip, you know, heads 50 times in a row.
Exactly. So I want to know, Larry Lepard, why are you not a dumb monkey?
Well, you know, first of all, let's talk about that theory for a moment. I mean, if that theory were true, a Warren Buffett couldn't exist, right? And so there's some truth to the theory that the market is somewhat efficient. Everyone's looking at the same information. And obviously, you know, things do get somewhat efficiently priced. But within that, there's a lot of slip between the cup and the lip. And some people seem to have the ability. Buffett is one of them. I'm not saying I'm Warren Buffett. I'm not. And my record's not as good. But my point is that people who study these things can generate the ability to go somewhat against the grain and to sometimes see where things are going in advance of them going there. And so as a result, and the biggest mistake that people tend to make in the market, and it's happened, and this is by studying markets and so forth for my whole career, is they tend to look in the rearview mirror. They tend to kind of extrapolate. And it's a natural human tendency. Well, if something was this way in the past, it'll probably be that way in the future. There's a lot of truth to that. And so they tend to herd. and follow trends as they were developed in the past. And the way that one can outperform the market, I think, is to see the points in time when the herd has gone too far in one direction and carried it too far. And they're, you know, in a sense, you become a contrarian and you say, you know what? Yes, that was a trend that worked, but you know what? It's ending. And now this other trend is going to work. And I'm going to get in early on this other trend. And other people are going to come join me in my views. I mean, they're slowly but surely going to change their views to support mine. And so they're, you know, I'm buying these things now because they're cheap. And in 5 years or 10 years, they're going to agree with me that they were undervalued and they're going to be valued much more highly. And so I'm going to have my performance is going to beat their performance. That's kind of the theory of why you want a good fund manager who kind of looks at the big picture.
The thing is, if somebody were managing my money, I would want that person pursuing a strategy that doesn't just really pay off if the fiat system suffers a major collapse. Because that could be, who knows how far into the future that would be. I think it took far longer for 2008 to occur than any of us anticipated. So I don't want something where, yeah, I'll be vindicated, but 100 years after I'm dead.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's a good point. So what you want to try to do, in my opinion, to answer that, you know, look, the fund I run will do unbelievably well if fiat collapses, but fiat does not need to collapse for my fund to do well. What I would submit to you is that we had, and this is important, and let's just go back, let's go to macro for a minute, big picture macro, okay? We had a period of inflation in the 70s and it peaked with gold at 800 up, you know, 22x from early 1970 when it was 35. And we began a period of deflation as a result of Volcker hiking interest rates. And we basically lived through 40 years of deflation from 1980 to 2022. And we started with interest rates at 20%. And by 2020, you know, the bottom of 2020, we had negative interest rates all throughout Europe and a 10-year that was yielding 1.3%. I mean, it's just we couldn't get any lower in yields. We couldn't have had greater deflation. And that was based on computers and chips and technologies and China bringing a billion hardworking people into the marketplace and globalization. And, you know, we found a bunch of oil in the United States. We fracked and found more oil than we thought was there, et cetera, et cetera. So we had all of these deflationary trends going in our favor for the past 40 years. And what you're seeing happen right now, and COVID kicked it off, and to me, you know, March 2020 was a blow off top in the deflationary trend. We've now reversed course, and we are now in an inflationary world, and we can't put it back in the bottle, okay? And COVID started it, supply chain issues started it, we've underinvested in commodities, the demographics are changing. I mean, in 1980, the boomer generation, of which I'm a part of, I'm 65, the boomer generation was coming into the workforce. It held labor costs down because there were a lot of us. Now the boomer generation is retiring and all the younger people have to support us. So labor is about to get a big raise because wage rates are going to have to go up a lot because there aren't as many people working. And so you've got these inflationary trends that have emerged. And what you've got going on in the stock market and in the investing world that I live in and all investors live in is everyone thinks we're going back to the deflationary trend. They think this is just a blip. And so if you look at the five-year swaps on, you know, in the inflation bet, everyone thinks we're going back to 2 or 3% inflation. I'm here to say, no way, not happening. We are in an inflationary world now. And as a result of that, very few people understand that, and everyone is mispositioned for that. Because if we have serious inflation, Tom, for the next 10 or 15 years, bonds are doomed. A lot of these growth stocks, they're doomed. And if you go back and you study 1970s, what you see is that the good performing investments in the 1970s were commodities, oil, gold, wheat, silver, and oil. I mean, yeah, commodities basically was the only thing that really worked. Bonds got destroyed because there was enormous inflation and regular stocks kind of went sideways for 10 years. So, you know, you got to start, at least in the way I see it is I start with the theme, the big theme. And so even if the currency does not collapse, and it may not, you know, you want to just make sure you are on the right side of a macro trend. And so my bet is that we are no longer in a deflationary world. We have entered an inflationary period. It may not last for more than 10 years, but certainly we're only a year or two into it. And so I think it's got quite a ways to run. And I think as everyone adjusts their views, they're going to come in this direction. And it's going to make the things that I've invested in perform extremely well.
Well, I'm not expecting you to, you know, give away all your information, but what are the classes of assets that we... Oh, yeah. Okay, then, yeah, whatever you want to share,
I'm happy to give away information. Yeah, so in general, the general theme is commodities and stuff versus, you know, bonds and growth. And, you know, I mean, this is uranium, this is oil, I mean, this is lithium, this is gold, this is silver, you know, it's wheat. In this period of deflation, the market got the wrong signals and we underinvested in the things we need to live our lives. And that's why when it finally broke out of the downtrend, the inflation was so virulent. I mean, we've had really bad inflation. And sadly, we're not going to be able to just solve it instantly because we've had the inflation in large part because the supply, we haven't had the supply. And we haven't invested in the supply. And, you know, investing in supply in these days, it takes time. I mean, you don't just turn on the tap and suddenly you got more oil. Turn on the tap, suddenly you got more wheat. Turn on the tap, suddenly you got more gold. I mean, it takes capital and it takes time to provide more supply to bring prices back in line. So what my fund has done is I focused on silver and gold and silver and gold mining stocks. But I mean, take an area like lithium. I mean, everyone says we need to go to more efficient cars. We need to have an electric car fleet, which one could argue that may not look as smart as we think it is if electricity costs continue to go up. But let's, for the sake of argument, say we're trending towards an electric car fleet. We need lithium to make those batteries. I mean, there are plenty of charts, and I've got lithium investments in my fund. There are plenty of charts which show that we need 10, the world in 5 years will need 10 times the amount of lithium that we're mining right now. So, you know, guess what? You know, companies that are mining lithium are about to do extraordinarily well. So, you know, these are the kinds of things you just, what you want to do, in my opinion, is you want to get in front of a major trend that has years to run. And you want to do it. And the beautiful thing is, we're not paying that much to do it. I mean, if I look at a lot of the stocks in my portfolio, you know, I mean, so Apple and Google, Apple, for example, it's growing at 5% a year. It's trading at 25 times earnings. It's the best technology company in the world, no doubt. Okay. But it's trading at 25 times, you know, cash flow. All right. I've got gold mining companies that are growing 50 to 100% a year and are trading at 3 times cash flow. That's a big divergence, right? And so what I can easily see is Apple going sideways and my stuff going up a lot. Because at the end of the day, when you're buying a stock, you're buying a stream of cash flows. And so, you know, my point is that everyone loved Apple because it was a great play in a deflationary world. But in an inflationary world, those phones will get more expensive. People won't be buying as many of them. You know, the Android will probably take bigger share over time. And, you know, people will be paying more for everything in their lives. And that everything includes oil, gas, et cetera. So that's kind of the, you know, the big picture of what I'm doing. Within that, there are specific names that I like. So,
well, I'm curious about gold mining stocks. There's one in particular, B2 Gold. Now, for years, people have said, oh, this thing is so undervalued. Oh, it is a screaming buy. Yeah. You better get in this thing. And you just sit there and wait and wait and just watch it get worse. But it's screaming buy because it's way undervalued. I mean, at what point do you say, I'm not so sure about this?
Well, yeah, I don't own B2 and I know the company extremely well. It's got nice cash flows. It's not overpriced. The issue there is it's not growing that quickly. And it's in a jurisdiction that a lot of people don't like. They're in Africa. But, you know, look, these stocks, they are cyclical, right? I mean, just to give some data points, the profitability in these businesses is very much driven by the price of the thing they're selling. So when gold is running and it's going higher, these stocks go up and they go up fast. I mean, as an example, in 2019, my fund was up 98% in a year, okay? And in, you know, 2020, my fund was up, you know, 122% in a year. So, you know, back to back, you know, my fund went up 4x almost, okay? Having said that, you know, at that point in time, things peaked. You know, Powell started to hint that he's getting tougher. You know, gold settled in around, you know, 1900 to 2000. And, you know, we've given some of that back. And this is very typical. I mean, you know, investment trends are like waves on a beach, right? I mean, you want to be on the right side of the tide, but the tide comes up, then the tide goes out a little bit. So fine. You know, we've given back a good piece of, not a good piece, but we've given back a meaningful piece of those gains. And, you know, but we're waiting for the next wave. And in my opinion, the next wave is coming as you watch kind of the monetary authorities and what they're doing. And you watch the way the world is really starting to break in lots of cases. And those of us who follow these things carefully know that ultimately when things do break, their solution will be to print more money. And as they print more money, that will drive gold through 2000. Then we'll be on our way to 3000 and we'll get the next wave up. So, you know, you can't buy a gold stock and 3 months later go, oh, I haven't made money or it's gone down a bit. I mean, when you buy these things, you have to recognize that they're volatile. You know, if you're careful, what you try to do is you look at the charts, you try to buy them. And frankly, right now is a good time to buy them because they've been thrown out and the sentiment is horrible. You know, unfortunately, the way investors often behave is that, you know, right after I had those two big up years, a ton of money came flowing in, right? Like, oh my God, this is great. We're going to make a ton of money in gold stocks. I want to buy these things. And, you know, they bought them right before a correction. And, you know, it's now my job and I'm holding their hand saying, you know, look, if you have a 2 to 5 year view on these things, and that's what you really should do. You know, we're not trading. We're not speculating here. You know, investing is taking capital, thinking about a big theme, you know, asking yourself if you're right about that theme, putting it to work, and then letting it compound over, you know, multiple years. As an example, let's look at the last trend. You know, Amazon was a killer stock from 2009 to present. I mean, if you'd have bought it, you'd have made thousands of percent on your money, right? And yet, throughout that entire run, there were several times, Bill Miller was in it, and he talks about this, when it was down 30 or 40%. So, you know, okay, great. It goes up a great deal, corrects 30 or 40%. And you can, you know, you had to decide at that point in time, do I still believe in the thesis? And by the way, if you bought it right at the peak before it corrected 40%, and then you felt like an idiot because it corrected 30 or 40% or even 50%, I think in one case, you might say, oh, shit, I blew it. I'm going to sell it. I mean, and that's how a lot of investors get themselves into trouble. I mean, it was a great study. Peter Lynch ran the Magellan Fund at Fidelity, and he had an unbelievable track record. I mean, like, you know, 30% compounded for a bunch of years, as good as Buffett, better maybe. And then they went and they studied all his clients, everyone who owned Fidelity. As it turns out, like only half of them actually ended up making money with it. And those were the ones who bought it and forgot about it, and just bought it and let it compound. The other half, they would say, oh my God, look at it, it's running hard. I'm going to go buy it. They'd buy it. It would go down. They'd say, oh shit, I made a mistake. They'd sell it. You know, then it would run hard again. Oh no, I was right the first time. I'm going to go buy it again. I mean, you know, people have to understand that their human emotions sometimes really work against them with respect to investing. It's the one area where, you know, I mean, if you go to the supermarket and steak is half price, you're like, this is great. I get to buy steak half price. But in investing, you know, people are like, no, I want that steak when it's really expensive. I want to chase it. You know, you have to fight your emotions there, and you got to get a theme and you got to know what you're doing. And you try and buy it when it's on sale. And you wait and you give it some time and it's going to, you know, you're going to come out ahead. At least that's been my experience in, you know, 35 years or 40 years of doing this. So,
do you have a recommended percentage allocation breakdown for, let's say a person of reasonable means? So we're talking cash, precious metals, Bitcoin, stocks. I mean, some people like to venture into real estate and other things. I mean, so we don't have to get into like the art world or anything like that. But,
yeah.
But basic asset classes, how should it break down?
Well, it really depends on everybody's different risk tolerance. But for a lot of people, you know, just commercial real estate and rental properties is, you know, one of the safer areas. I mean, there are a lot of people who are afraid of the stock market and they get involved in real estate. And if they've done it right and careful, they do pretty well. So I always think that's not a bad place to put wealth. But assuming you're talking financial assets now, you used to be able to buy bonds and they were working pretty well because it was a deflationary world. I mean, I would say this, I think bonds now are probably the worst investment choice anyone could make. If I had any bonds, I would sell them. I think they're going to be debased. I don't think they're going to, you know, there's no interest rate in my view that will protect you against what's coming. So having said that, you know, I think there's some argument for just having some cash, because if we have a really big economic downturn, you want to be able to buy bargains. But then, okay, money that you can risk and, you know, use as a risk allocation, probably your safest and base should be in gold. You know, it never draws down more than 20 or 30%. It maintains purchasing power over long periods of time. They can't take it away from you. It can't go bankrupt. There's no management team, et cetera. So, you know, maybe a third in gold, something like that. You know, and so I put silver in there too, although it's a little bit more volatile. You know, and then maybe a third in stocks, and then maybe, you know, another third in Bitcoin. I mean, Bitcoin is extremely aggressive. It's very volatile, and you have to be able to handle the drawdowns. But I actually think it's the most asymmetric bet in the world today. And I tell my clients, and a lot of them are gold bugs, and they were very skeptical of Bitcoin. And I say to them, guys, you know, this thing is working. It's a digital form of gold. It is sound. It's not Dogecoin or Terra Luna or any of those shit coins. It's the real deal. And it's got more asymmetric upside than anything else in the world today. And you're going to regret it if you don't own some. Now, you know, if you're 75 or 80 years old, maybe your allocation is 5%. You know, I mean, at minimum, you start at 1%. And, you know, personally, I'm quite heavily allocated to Bitcoin. It's, you know, well, I'll confess it's more than half for me, but I'm a very aggressive investor. And the balance is in silver and gold and silver and gold mining companies. So, you know, I wouldn't recommend that for everybody because, you know, there are people who, you know, I know people who saw it run and they bought it at 68,000 recently and went to 17.5 and they're freaking out. I mean, my view is it went to 75. I'm like, oh boy, this is great. I get to buy some more again. So, you know, you have to know what your temperament is and know what your time frame is. That's the other thing. I mean, I'm playing with money. I have a very long timer. It's really money for my kids. This is not the milk money. You know, I mean, and I always maintain a fairly good sized cash balance just because, you know, if we have a Great Depression and the price of everything plunges, I want to buy good assets cheaply. That's what investing is all about. So, you know, the allocations, I mean, let me say one thing, Tom, you kind of asked the big picture question, how much you put in any bucket. I think that the traditional, and I see a lot of people like this, you know, the 60-40 portfolio that most people's financial advisors push them on, you know, 60% stocks, 40% bonds, or vice versa, depending on their age, that should be gone. The bonds, you should throw them out. You got.
Yeah, I was going to say, I would. The only thing I would change about that 40% bonds, I'd take the 4 out of the 40.
Exactly. So the bond piece should be gone. So, okay, so now you got money to invest. I mean, look, you're not, you know, your cash is getting debased, but at least you're not going to lose it. They're not going to take it away from you. So, and I view gold as a kind of cash that can't be printed, okay? What I tend to tell people is I say, look, if you don't have 10 to 30% of your net worth in sound money bets, you're really taking a lot of risk. And by sound money bets, I mean things that cannot be debased, things that protect you against what I believe is a very, very high probability of very meaningful inflation in the next 15 or 20 years. And so your house is a sound money bet. It's something you can live in. You know, it costs money to replace it. You know, great. So your house is going to protect you. In the 70s, I mean, you know, my parents had a house in the Midwest. They bought for $40,000. By the end of the 70s, it was probably worth $400,000. It was a 10-bagger. It was just a house, right? And that's what we're talking about here. I mean, if we have massive inflation, housing will hold its value. It's a real asset. But, you know, gold, silver, they'll do it too. And gold and silver mining stocks, I think, will do it even more so. I believe Bitcoin is an emerging class that will do it. But, you know, you want to be diversified. You don't want to have all your eggs in one basket, for sure.
Before I go on, let me say a quick thing that will help a lot of you, and you know who you are. If you are in business and you're getting buried by your competition online, then build your brand, your reputation, and your lead flow with digital marketing by Persist SEO, our great sponsor. If you're a small local business, you're trying to compete against large companies in the service industry, increase your visibility with Persist SEO. Or if you have low or no leads coming in on a consistent basis, well, website search engine and conversion optimization can help move the needle to a more prosperous business model for you. If you're tired of cold calling, use your website as a lead generation engine. If you're not showing up for your services on the search engines, then get found with Persist SEO's expert search engine optimization. All you have to do is call 770-580-3736 or visit them at ineedseo.help for a free website audit and consultation. That's 770-580-3736 or ineedseo.help. Talk to me about the situation that the Federal Reserve is in right now. I can hear already that it's kind of a delicious question to answer.
Oh, yeah. Well, boy, are they in a pickle. They've got themselves into a mess. I mean, we're at the end of a sovereign debt bubble, and you know they're damned if they do, and they're damned if they don't. I mean, what they've been able to do is continually paper over every level, you know, they create a bubble, the bubble bursts, they print more money, they create another bubble. And, you know, I mean, unless Martians come in and we get kicked up to, I mean, so the first bubble was the dot-com bubble. It burst. Fine. You know, Bernanke even said, we got to get a housing, you know, bubble going to fight the deflation that this bursting of the dot-com bubble is going. So he took interest rates down to 1% and boom, housing took off like a rocket. And so we had the housing bubble in 2008. Well, that collapsed and they took interest rates down to 0%, 0% interest rates from 2009 to 2015. And that was just an abomination. It was such a misallocation of capital. And so as a result of that, they created another stock, you know, an everything bubble, a bond boom and a stock boom. And so now that one's bursting. And the Fed is damned if they do and they're damned if they don't. If they, you know, they've got an inflation problem and they should tighten interest rates and they should tighten monetary conditions to fight that inflation problem. That's what Powell is doing. Okay. But the problem with that is they're going to tighten it so much, this bubble is going to burst and it's going to look like the Great Depression. And so, you know, there's a lot of debate about what he'll do next. And my suspicion is he's serious about trying to calm down the inflation. But my further suspicion and knowledge is that when the system breaks and things stop working and the U.S. bond market starts to fail, which I believe it will, he's going to have to come back in and print again. And so they'll have to go to yield curve control or else, you know, inflation will run away. I think we are actually at the end game of this monetary system. I know that's hard to believe. I know I've said it before. I've been believing it since 2008, you know, and it's entirely possible that they could drag this out a bit longer, but things are getting pretty damn desperate. I mean, I was reading this morning about energy costs in Europe. And I'm sure you're aware of what's going on over there. I mean, you know, electricity costs there are just, you know, they're on a tear and businesses are going to start failing left and right. And so the Europeans are going to be forced with a choice. I mean, they can either make a deal with Russia, which they probably won't do, or they're going to have to start subsidizing businesses. Well, fine, you can subsidize your business. How are you going to do that? You're going to print more money to do that. What's that? That's debasement. That's inflation. So the Fed is trapped in a dilemma of they're damned if they do. If they tighten, they're going to burst the bubble and crater the economy. If they don't want to do that, they're going to have to print into an inflation hurricane, and that hurricane's only going to get worse. So it's really a mess. And I don't think the market, I don't think most people fully understand it, and I don't think the markets fully understand it. And to be honest with you, I don't fully understand it in the sense that I don't know how it will play out, but I want to be prepared for the tail risks of both of those things. I want to be prepared in case they over-tighten and we get a deflationary collapse, which is possible, or in case they flip and start to print more and we get runaway inflation, which I also think is possible. And we'll probably have a little bit of both throughout this, which is, by the way, what makes this whole, you know, investment problems right now so hard. I mean, I use the term economic whiplash. I mean, I feel like these guys have created economic whiplash. I mean, they, you know, COVID came along and they went nuts. They handed out money, they cut interest rates, they printed money. I mean, it was insane. I mean, they were buying mortgage bonds into the biggest housing price spikes in the history of the world. I mean, much bigger than the bubble that was created in the housing boom. I mean, house prices were 20% year on year. It's nuts, right? And they kept buying mortgage bonds, right? And then, by the way, they're saying, and we're not worried about inflation, it's transitory. Well, of course, now we know that's not true and it's not transitory. We've got runaway inflation. It's terrible. And says, okay, fine. Let's slam on the brakes. Let's not just maybe slow things down a little bit. No. Let's go into the fastest, hardest rate tightening cycle in the history of the Fed. And let's start to do QT at 2x the size. And when they did the QT that they're doing right now in 2018, it broke the market. And now they're doing twice that size. So, you know, okay, fine. You want to go in that direction? Great. You know, you are creating, I mean, being a business person in this environment is brutal. I mean, you know, come on, Fed, what is it? You know, are we going for inflation or are we going for massive deflation? And what they should be trying to do, obviously, is steer somewhere in the middle, but they don't seem to be very good at doing that. And that's what makes this climate so treacherous for investors.
And yet, even without this climate, it's a tricky thing to be a good investor because, as you say, you know, you have to do an enormous amount of research. Like you were saying that the key thing is to figure out what the trends are and to get in ahead of them. But again, that takes a lot of research that a lot of us don't have the time to do. So since I believe in the division of labor, I feel like in this, as in other areas of life, I would want to outsource this to somebody who is knowledgeable, who devotes himself to it all the time, and who is going to have specialized knowledge that I just wouldn't have the time to acquire and maybe not the talent to acquire.
Right.
But yet, money managers don't have a very good reputation.
Well, yes and no. I mean, it depends on, yeah, you're right. I mean, first of all, you know, it's hard to beat the market. You know, most of us don't. And by the way, my record's been pretty good, but I've blown it too. We all blow it from time to time. You know, what I think in general you want to try and do is you want to diversify a little bit. You never put all your eggs in with one money manager. But when you do find a good one and you find somebody who's got a history and a record of beating it and you believe and you understand what they're doing, and your beliefs about the future align with their beliefs about the future, you know, I think it is an intelligent thing to give them capital and let them manage it. I mean, that's what they're being paid to do. And I know in my case, all my money is in my fund. So Well, that's true to the extent all my money that's not in physical gold and Bitcoin is in my fund. So, you know, I eat what I serve. I mean, unfortunately, a lot of the money managed on Wall Street, a lot of these mutual funds, they're really not in that same boat. They're very much, they're marketing machines. They're all about just telling a good story and raising as much money as possible. You know, they don't have as much of their own skin in the game. And so, you know, incentives are an important piece of this whole equation, Tom. You want to have somebody who's got their incentives very much aligned so that, you know, my clients are going to, I mean, whatever happens to my fund, it's happening to me and my clients. And so if I'm wrong, I'm going to suffer. Now, I don't want to be wrong, and I hope I won't be, but at least I'm making the exact same bet with my own capital.
I want to ask you a question just out of pure selfish curiosity
sure.
that I think might also be of interest to the general listener. But, you know, something like Bitcoin, there's yeah. almost a, I don't mean this as an insult. I really don't because I like Bitcoin, but there's almost a cult around the idea of holding on no matter what. Right?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Right? You're gonna hold on to your Bitcoin. But with stocks, there's this buy and hold mentality.
Right.
But how do you know, let's say you're dealing with a particular stock.
Right.
How do you know when to say, I've taken enough pain, I got to just bail out? Because there's this instinct feels like, I can't leave this stock until I've at least made my money back, and then I'll get out. You know, like there's this, you know, like yeah, I'm not going to let this thing beat me. But on the other hand, you don't want to leave prematurely. At what point do you say, yeah, this thing is never coming back? I got
to
get out.
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, and what you alluded to is kind of anchoring. I mean, when I get back to even, I'll get out. So the way we handle it is we look at situations and we say, what's the thesis here? And when something starts to not work, you know, we say, has the thesis changed? Were we wrong about our assessment of this management team? You know, why isn't this working? And sometimes it's just as simple as, well, the market's not going that way right now and everyone's kind of down on it. But frankly, we think the market's wrong and they misunderstand it. I mean, this is kind of the Michael Burry bet, right? You know, that there was a time, as you recall, if you watched The Big Short, where his bet was not working, but he understood the underlying dynamics of the housing market and said, you know what? You know, I'm making a bet here that the market's wrong. And if I can wait long enough, I'm going to be proven right. And he was in spades. And so that's really, in my view, the way you deal with it. You try to ask yourself, am I wrong about this or not? And if you are, you know, you retreat. You know, you take your lumps and you move on. You find something that you know you're 100% right about. You know, and it varies. I mean, there are a lot of levels of, are you wrong? Are you wrong about the thesis? Are you wrong about the management team? Are you wrong about the conditions of this company? I mean, there are lots of parts where you can be right or wrong. And, you know, we are always evaluating all of the above with respect to every place where we have capital, you know, and you spread your bets around. I mean, what we try to do, I mean, we have, you know, lots of names in our portfolio and we get it wrong. You know, the thing I think is important for people to understand, the way you invest successfully, Tom, is you look for asymmetric situations. I mean, one of my first mentors in this business, a great old guy, he said, Larry, so the greatest thing about this business is you can only lose 1x and you can make 2x, 3x, 5x, 10x. He said, and you guess what? You're going to lose 1x occasionally. You got to get used to that. That's just the way the game works. But if you're picking things well enough and carefully enough and you understand them, you know, the 2x's and the 5x's and the 10x's, they're going to make up for the 1x that you lose, right? And that's asymmetry, right? So as we try to buy stocks, we are always looking for asymmetry. You know we could be wrong. And if we're wrong, we'll lose the 1x. Generally, you don't lose the 1x. Generally, you start to figure out you're wrong. You're like, oh shit, this isn't working. And you lose 40% or 50%. And that hurts. But you know, the other one where you thought, you know, okay, if this works, we can make 2x. Turns out sometimes things do a lot better than you thought, and you make 4x or 6x. So, you know, it's really just a balancing. I mean, as we go through this, we very unemotionally and probabilistically try to assess risk and try to make sure that we are taking the right level of risk and that the weightings are correct so that if things don't work, you know, okay, that one blew it and it didn't work, but these others are all working and they're going to give us a multiple of what we put in them. That's really how you approach it.
So what do we say right now? Let's take two classes of people.
Yeah.
The most common question I get when I'm interviewing somebody like you is, I'm a guy who's got 10 grand and I don't know what I should be doing with it. Mm-hmm. And then on the other hand, we have a smaller group of people who have much larger fortunes, let's say.
Right.
But even they, just because you have a large fortune doesn't make you immune to the problems of the world. You want to protect that fortune.
Sure.
They need to do something. Now, obviously, maybe they should call you. But what is the different kind of advice you give to these different groups of people.
Yeah. I mean, if you're building a house, you start by building the foundation. I mean, if you only have 10 grand, the first thing you don't want to lose it. So, you want to have a foundation of some very sound things that will benefit from the trends I'm describing and where you won't have a big drawdown. And honestly, the best place in my opinion today to do that is gold. So if somebody came to me and said, I got 10 grand I want to invest, I said, fine, put $5,000 in gold. And they said, okay, so I want to get some speculative upside. Okay, put $1,000 in silver and $1,000 in Bitcoin. And then let's pick three gold stocks. I'll give you my three best names or something. Do you know what I mean? I mean, you start with the base of your portfolio as something that you know will hold its general value and will go up based on the theme that we're playing, which is monetary debasement. First of all, I'd want to make sure that this 10 grand investor or the big investor understands the monetary debasement theme and understands kind of the five-year window we're talking about here. I mean, this could happen tomorrow. It could take a couple of years to play out, but it's already playing out. I mean, gold, in 2015, gold was at 1,000. Now it's at 1,700. I believe it's going to 7,000 to 10,000. But, and the next big, signal point will be when it breaks through 2,000 with authority and stays there. We've had a triple top at around 2,000. In 2011, gold was at 1,900. In 2020, when, COVID hit and it squirted up to 2,050. And then earlier this year, it was at 2,070. So 2,000 is kind of the top in gold. And there's one thing that happens in investment markets. When things make new all-time highs, a lot of people jump in and push the trend. So 2,000 is the top. And gold is going to go through 2,000 sometime in the next year or two. I think probably in the next 6 months. And when it does, it's going to squirt up to 3,000. And all the gold stocks are going to go nuts, and the silver stocks will too. So the diversity I just described, I mean, that applies to the $10,000 investor or the multimillion-dollar investor. But, the multimillion-dollar investor might be willing to take more risk because, they've got a lot of money socked away in other areas. They've got their house paid for, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, everybody should understand that leverage is dangerous. You don't, rule number one, Buffett's rule one, and he's right, is you don't lose your money. You don't lose capital. And it's very easy to lose capital, very easy, chasing stupid shit, in any area. In Bitcoin, I mean, it's tragic. So, you start off by building a base and then you speculate with the pieces that where if you lose it, you won't, if you had 10 grand and you lost 1,000, your life wouldn't change. And if you had 10 grand, you invest 1,000 in something, you did a five bagger, that'd be pretty nice. That would enhance your overall portfolio return. So that's kind of how you view it.
If somebody wanted to talk to you or work with you, I assume you have a website or a way to be contacted?
Yep, absolutely. So the website is EMA2, Edward Mark Alpha, the number 2.com. The name of my firm is Equity Management Associates. We manage a fund. If you're a qualified investor, we can accept you in. We have a lot of investors in the fund. We're happy. We do Zoom calls to explain how we manage it. We're always onboarding new investors, kind of steady. And I'm also on Twitter and put out a lot of information on Twitter. The theme is monetary debasement. And monetary debasement insurance really is the theme of the fund. And so everybody who's got capital, got assets, got savings, in my opinion, needs to ask themselves, what am I doing to protect myself from monetary debasement? And by the way, I think this is going to happen in the whole world. I mean, I think, there are big pension funds, there are big college endowments, I'm starting to see it myself because I've gotten calls and people have talked to me. There are a lot of big pools of money that, given what's happened with COVID, given the inflation that we're now seeing, they're kind of starting to ask themselves, this is monetary debasement was not on their radar screen. That wasn't on their bingo card. They were like, all right, how do I get the most venture capital upside? How do I get the most technology stuff? Tell me about Web3, blah, blah, blah. Tell me about automated cars and so on and so forth. And, you're starting to see this category emerge. Oh, I get it. We're in a system here where the Fed's trapped. There is monetary debasement coming. How do I protect against that? And so that's what we're trying to address.
All right. I'll put that up on, I guess the show notes page is tomwoods.com/2196. So I'll put that link up there. Thanks so much, Larry. Great talking to you again.
Thank you, Tom.
All right, that's another week of episodes of The Tom Woods Show. On Monday, we'll be joined by our old friend, Viva Fry. If you don't know him, oh my goodness, that is a terrible shame we are just about to rectify. So if you've enjoyed this week and all the previous weeks of The Tom Woods Show, then join me as a supporting listener because, man, oh man, you get so many goodies, you're going to want to give some of them back to me because you're going to feel guilty. So check it out, supportinglisteners.com. I'll see you next week.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.